Catholic Answers Live. My name is Chris Check. I am president at Catholic Answers, and I am your guest host today. Your favorite regular host is Cy Kellett, and he is on a much-needed day of vacation, a much-earned day of vacation, I should say. I don't know if actually he needs it or not. We could all use some vacation, right, Nick? Every now and then, yeah. But in any case, he'll be back in this chair tomorrow, thanks be to God. And with me coming up in the second hour, Jimmy Akin, open forum. And as luck would have it, I used this joke yesterday, Jimmy. We have Jimmy on the first hour too. So 2 hours of Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Any questions about the Catholic faith? What the church teaches, why she teaches it, where is that supported in scripture? What are these strange practices that you Catholics have, et cetera, et cetera? Any questions that you have about the Catholic faith, we are here to answer them and bring you closer to Jesus Christ, we hope, in the process. 888-318-7884. 888-31-TRUTH is the number to get in the queue to ask your question for Jimmy. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers and Dean of the School of Apologetics at Catholic Answers. Right, Jimmy?
Hey, how you doing? Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Boy, that's
what's going on with the School of Apologetics.
Amen. And what a joy for me to see that thing, that school come to fruition. Been the topic of discussion actually since before I was at Catholic Answers, but a lot of moving parts, the establishment and growth of a video department, getting the right IT in place, a mature press for the written materials, and getting all coordinated. And that is one of your duties here at Catholic Answers.
And also getting instructors for the courses. And you just recorded a course for us yourself.
Why did you
tell us about that?
I did. I record this. John Versillo and his video team had the studio set up about a month ago, I guess, up in Vista, which is just north of us. And I recorded a short course that I think we're calling Making Sense of the Inquisition or Understanding the Inquisition, something like that. The Inquisition, of course, now it's not as long as the one that you've done, Introductory Apologetics or Introduction to Apologetics, or the one that Trent has done. But
it's a short course.
It's a short course, right. And the Inquisition, of course, is one of those neuralgic topics or controversial topics that especially non-Catholics, but not a few Catholics, like to use as a stick to kind of beat the Catholic Church and discredit her. And in fact, it is a complex and involved tale that has to be understood, among other things, in a moral and historical context. And so that's what I try to do in the course of that course.
So you're not saying it's just like all good?
Well, no. In fact, there were some excesses, to be sure. Anything involving people who have a fallen nature. We're going to see.
So you're kind of steering a middle course between Inquisition equals all bad and Inquisition equals all good. And you're kind of like doing that truth thing, right?
Yeah, the truth. That is what we trade in here at Catholic Answers, the truth.
Good,
yeah.
Good. Nice to know we're on brand.
Amen. So, like I say, an involved tale and one with some controversial figures, and also some people who had very, very good motives as well. And that's all part of the story. And I bring it right up to the present day, right down to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which finds its origins in the Inquisition. So,
but it does not employ remotely the same knowledge.
No, they've given up some of the old methods there. That is certainly true. So that should be out, I think, in early fall. I know that I have to get my study guide into Todd Aglioro in the publishing department here within a week. So, but I will not be working on that over the next 2 hours. Instead, I'm going to be hosting Catholic Answers Live. Right. And excellent. So 888-318-7884, open forum, Catholic Answers Live, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist. Let's go to Anonymous. watching on YouTube Live. Anonymous, thank you for watching on YouTube. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, good to be here.
Great.
So, Jimmy, I remember a call a while back. You're talking about how, you know, the human race has gone through different phases of history, and it has different phases of history, and that prior to, there are always ups and downs, and that prior to the end of time, there's going to be a major down. And I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, I know it's very speculative, but what could contribute to the end of time and a major downside scenario in human history? I mean, would it be something like a global genocide against Christians or a climate apocalypse? Or what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, there are any number of things one could speculate about as playing a part in it. And really, I tend not to go in an overly speculative route because it's easy to be deceived by your own ideas. I mean, like climate apocalypse, there's nothing in scripture that would suggest that. But, you know, because it's something that people are talking about these days, it's something that I can't say climate wouldn't play a role in what happens before the end. But also, there's just no biblical basis for saying that global warming is going to play any kind of a role here. And so it's easy to read our own fears about our own times and our own imminent futures or what people are saying about the future as if it were supported biblically. And that's a real danger when you're trying to get a handle on Bible prophecy, because there is a long, long track record of people making predictions that the end of the world is just around the corner, that it's going to occur within a few years, within our own lifetimes. There have been people like that all the way down through the centuries, and so far, every single one of them has been wrong. And what they would do is they would look to justify that speculation. They would look to events occurring in their own time and speculate that, oh, well, this must be something that's connected with biblical prophecy, even if there was little or no basis for that in the text of the Bible. So I try to avoid looking at specific trends today and focus more on what the biblical text would suggest. And there are a few things that are identified in the biblical text as plausible signs for the end. One of them is a massive apostasy from the faith. And by apostasy, I don't mean people getting wrong ideas about the faith. That's just heresy, and that's been around in every age. I also don't mean apostasy in a particular location. There have been apostasies in different locations before, like when Muslim forces conquered North Africa, which had previously been dominantly Christian, and there was a mass apostasy there. So if I see, like, say, an apostasy happening in a particular part of the world today, that's not automatically a sign of the end. But if we saw a global apostasy of people saying, I'm not Christian anymore, just severing all ties with the Christian faith, that could be a sign that the end is nearer than farther away. And right now, I don't see that, because even though there is a weakening of the faith in certain parts of the world, like in Europe and here in America, that's not the case in other parts of the world. In fact, the gospel is making great strides in other places, including Africa and East Asia. And so we're not seeing a global apostasy right now. Half of the global population identifies as Christian. And that's just not an apostasy when half of everybody who's alive is Christian. Another sign that is talked about, and this is alluded to also in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but it's also something St. Paul discusses in the book of Romans, is apparently there's going to be a notable conversion of non-Christian Jewish people to the Christian faith. Exactly what the shape of that will be, whether it'll be all Jews or just most non-Christian Jews, there's going to be some kind of notable conversion of the Jewish people to the Christian faith prior to the second coming. And while there has been some conversion As in every age, there have been conversions from non-Christian Judaism to Christianity. There has been some effort in that regard in, the 20th century, but that mass conversion that St. Paul seems to indicate will happen, that hasn't taken place yet. If you look at the Catechism, one of the things it talks about, and look around paragraph 676 for this information in the Catechism. I don't know why they didn't just adjust it by 10 and make it 666. But if you look around paragraph 676, you'll see a discussion of the Antichrist and associated events. And it appears that there will be a great persecution of the church, which is no doubt related to the apostasy. In one way or another. It also alludes to making a deal with falsehood for the sake of peace. So there may be, whether that's military peace or social peace or something, who knows. But I would point you to the Catechism of the Catholic Church for a look at the Church's understanding of this matter for more information.
Anonymous, I also will recommend to you a book the Catholic Answers Press came out with a couple of years ago, and you can get it at shop.catholic.com, and it's called What Jesus Really Said About the End of the World, and it picks up some of these things that it's by David Curry that Jimmy was talking about, including as he began the answer to his question by saying, so far everybody's gotten it wrong. So What Jesus Really Said About the End of the World, David Curry, shop.catholic.com.
Also, I've got a 20 Answers End Times booklet coming out later this year, and there's already out a 20 Answers Biblical Prophecy booklet that I wrote that's already available.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. My friends, how would you like to be able to answer questions about the Catholic faith and the Bible as well as Jimmy Akin? The good news is that you can, but it's going to take some work. I'm looking at this copy that Carrie gave us. You can. Well, I know you put it's a lifetime of study. With hard work and the right tools, you can learn Catholic apologetics. And Catholic Answers wants to help, which is why we created the School of Apologetics that Jimmy and I were talking about at the top of the hour. So right now, you can get the first course in Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. Got to start somewhere. It's called Beginning Apologetics, and we are offering it at the special introductory price of $50 off. That's right. We've priced the introductory module at the super low price to get you started, and we know that you are going to love it. One student said, Jimmy does a great job kicking off the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics with the Beginning Apologetics course. I found it well organized and highly informative. I can't wait for the next offering. This course was a pleasure. Jimmy presented the material in a logical way. Learned so much and highly recommend this great course. My friends, great summer activity. Here it is. Visit schoolofapologetics.com to take advantage of this great deal. Right back after this.
Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
I firmly believe that prayer is communication with God. And if we know that God is a loving Father, why wouldn't we want to talk to God? The reality is, we've got to talk to our family, we've got to talk to our friends, and if God is real, and God is definitely real, He wants to hear about our day. He also wants to know how we're doing and what our needs are. Prayer is communication with God.
Eight 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 Truth. My name is Chris Check. I am sitting in for Cy Kellett, my guest, Jimmy Akin. All the phones are full, but keep trying. Open forum, Catholic Answers Live. We will answer any questions about the Catholic faith. Gabriel, 9 years old, calling from the great city of Houston in the great Lone Star State of Texas. Gabriel, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you.
What's your question, my young friend?
When you see an angel, how do you know if it's real?
Wow.
Okay. The basic way, and it's a good to ask, because sometimes people imagine things, or sometimes they dream things, or sometimes if they're sick, they may even hallucinate things, which is kind of like dreaming something, even though you're not asleep. And so, you need to ask. And the way to do that is to, if you see an angel and, or what you think may be an angel, ask the angel to do something that only an angel could do. You know, you want to be polite and respectful because angels are powerful, but ask the angel if he can do something that only an angel could do, like, perform a miracle or predict the future or something like that. And it should be something that no human could fake and that there would be no arguing about it. Like, for example, suppose someone put on angel wings, you know, like a costume, and appeared to you and said, "Hi, I'm an angel." And you say, "Okay, well then predict the future." And they say, "Oh, the sun's going to come up tomorrow." Well, humans can predict that the sun is going to come up tomorrow. It needs to be something that you can't just predict. Or if you said, you know, do something only an angel could do. Well, maybe the person's a stage magician and says, "Oh, well, I'll make a rabbit come out of my hat." And he does. Well, stage magicians can do that. So it needs to be something that a human simply couldn't do. Also, anytime you're in communication with someone you think may be an angel, whether they are or aren't, you should tell your parents about it. Yes. And if your parents, once your parents are involved, they may also want to talk to a priest who, you know, may bring in an expert in discerning such matters. But it's important that you let people know about this and you let them know what's going on, and then they can use the wisdom that God has given them to help guide you through the situation.
How about that, Gabriel? Does that help you out?
Yes.
Good, 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 good. Gabriel, you're 9 years old. You've made your first communion?
Yes.
Good, good, good. Well, pray for Catholic Answers, all right? Every day, all right?
Okay. I'm interested in knowing, Gabriel, do you think you've seen an angel possibly?
Yeah. No.
All right.
No. Okay. Well, it's good to be aware of what to do if you ever do.
And be on the lookout. Yeah. You never know. Great. Thank you very much, Gabriel. So, Jimmy, one of those things would not be, for example, a test for an angel, conjugating, you know, a third conjugation, a regular Latin verb or something like that. Probably a human could do that.
Anyone who has taken a Latin class could do that.
I think so, yeah. Let's go to Fabian, also in the Lone Star State, from New Braunfels, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Fabian, thanks for using the Catholic Answers app, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. So I had a Protestant friend say that purgatory is not necessary because once the body leaves the soul no longer has bodily wants and therefore will no longer be inclined to turn away from God. I believe I responded to him adequately, but I was wondering if I could get your input. Also, I believe this belief is tied to a heretical group that believed that the body was inherently evil and the soul was inherently good. What was this heretical group?
Oh, well, there have been a variety of groups who have said things like that down through the centuries. Various forms of the heresy known as Gnosticism have claimed that the body was evil. They're probably the most famous for it, though there have been other groups as well.
Jimmy, I talk about the Cathars in my talk on the Inquisition.
I was going to mention the Cathars are kind of a medieval equivalent or possibly even offshoot of earlier Gnosticism. Also Manichaeans, you know, the sect that St. Augustine was part of before he was a Christian. So there have been a variety of people who've claimed that. In terms of how I would respond, well, it's true that according to the classical thought on this subject, there are three sources of sin, the world, the flesh, and the devil. And so the flesh, even though that's understood really to mean human nature, is one of those things. But and it's also true that we do have bodily temptations that are disordered that can, you know, for example, make you want to eat too much or engage in intimate behavior with people you have no right to do that with, or various other things that are, you know, bodily in origin. It's clearly not the case that sin is just rooted in our bodies. And a really good example of that is the devil, because the devil does not have a body, and his angels do not have bodies, at least not natively. And so when they fell away from God, that shows that even purely spiritual beings that don't have bodies are capable of being tempted to turn their backs on God and sin. Now, that means that just because we don't have a body at the point of our death doesn't mean that we are automatically free of temptation. We will, by God's grace, be instantaneously freed from sin if we die in God's friendship. We're not going to be sinning. But there's been damage to our spirits as a result of original sin and the kind of lives we've led and so forth. And it may take time to clean that up. And that's one thing that purgatory is thought to do. Purgatory is simply the final stage of our sanctification that makes us perfectly holy and able to experience the full glory of heaven. So that could take time. The church doesn't really have a teaching about this. And as a result of that, it also could happen instantaneously. It could happen in the twinkling of an eye, to use a biblical phrase. And so that's actually something that that Pope Benedict XVI talks about in his encyclical on Christian hope, Spes Salvi. If you look up his teaching on purgatory in Spes Salvi, one of the points he makes is that purgatory can't be measured in time the way we experience it. It's more of an existential event or something that happens to us. It's an experience that is real, but is one that you can't simply measure in earthly time, because we really don't know how time works in the afterlife. And so consequently, your friend's point doesn't really go to the issue. He seems to be assuming that the minute you lose your body, everything's going to be fine. Well, and it may be true that the minute you lose your body, everything's going to be fine. But if it's fine, it's because God has made it fine. It's because God has purified you, however long or short that takes, whether it's years or whether it's in the twinkling of an eye. It's because of God's work in your soul that you're sanctified and you're made holy. And so regardless of whether purgatory is long or short, it's necessary. If you're not perfectly pure at the moment you die, and you are perfectly pure at the moment you're in heaven, then it's clear between death and heaven must come a purification. Whether it takes a significant amount of time or not is up to God.
Fabian, our colleague Carlo Broussard right now is at work on a book about purgatory that will be out this fall, so watch for that. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Let's go to Giovanni in Rhode Island. Did I get the accent there correct on the right syllable?
Oh, you got it. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's something I never heard before, but good job. My question is the Old Testament. It says it seems to be a repetitive theme that God hardens the hearts of the enemies of Israel. If he can harden hearts, right, why can't he just soften them? And if he does harden hearts, how does he do it, directly or indirectly? Because that's something I've been struggling with, reading the Old Testament.
Yovani, we're coming up against the clock. We'll see if we can, if not, we'll pick it up after the break.
So to at least get a start on the answer, we have to understand the way that Old Testament authors write. They have a worldview where there are all kinds of competing people who believe in competing gods. And so one of the things they do is they really stress the idea that the true God is in control, that he is almighty, that he is not like the gods of the nations. And so they use a kind of literary form of speech called hyperbole, which is exaggeration to make a point. And we'll pick up that point on the other side of the break.
888-318-7884. I'm Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for Cy Kellett. My guest is Jimmy Akin. It's open forum. Questions about the Catholic faith? Right back after this.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy. I'm really proud of the two episodes of Catholic Answers Focus that we have for you this week. And if you haven't yet become a subscriber to our free podcast, this is definitely the week you should start. Monday, we've got an interview with Father Hugh Barber about the relationship between your soul and the Blessed Trinity. How is it that the triune God relates to your soul? Talk about news you can use. And Wednesday, we tackle Christopher Columbus with the world's leading Columbus scholar, Dr. Carol Delaney. Is it time to give up on Columbus? In the light of modern scholarship, should we be taking down Columbus statues and murals? Prepare to be surprised by the truth of the man. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Focus wherever you get your podcasts or listen anytime at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Catholic Answers Live.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, all shook up.
Feeling anxious, shaken up? We're going to help you find your peace.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now, back to Catholic Answers.
Catholic Answers Live. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett. The number to call, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, before the break, you were helping Yovani with a question about what it means when we read that God hardens people's hearts in the Old Testament.
Yeah, so the biblical authors use, they really want to stress that God is in control and that nothing would happen if God didn't at least allow it. But to make that point, they frequently use a form of speech called hyperbole. Hyperbole is exaggeration to make a point. It's like if someone's done something nice for me and I'm grateful and I say, oh, thanks a million. Well, that's hyperbole. I'm not envisioning literally thanking the person a million times, but I'm making the point with this exaggeration. And similarly, when Jesus says, in order to avoid sin, cut off your hand or pluck out your eye, that's exaggeration to make a point. It's hyperbole. He means do whatever you need to do to deal with sin, but he doesn't envision literally plucking out your eye or literally cutting off your hand, because really the root of sin is in your heart, and simply plucking out, cutting off your hand would not deal with the root of sin. You'd still have temptation. You'd still be able to sin. His point is do what you need to do to deal with it. So when we look at the way God is discussed in the Old Testament, especially, we find the biblical authors using hyperbole to emphasize God's control over world events. And this results in a form of speech where they will at times attribute things directly to God. For example, if you read the historical books of the Old Testament and you compare what's written in the books of Samuel versus what's written in the books of Chronicles, you look at the account of David taking a census of Israel, which is something he was not supposed to do in that circumstance. And in one book, it'll say God caused David to take the census. But in another book, it'll say the devil caused David to take the census. And since we know the census is sinful, that David shouldn't have done it, it's the last that the devil stirred up David to take the census. And when it says God did it, what it means, it's exaggeration to make a point that God is ultimately in control. It means God allowed the devil to stir up David. But we know that it doesn't mean God himself really caused David to sin, because that would make God the author of sin, and that's inconsistent with God's holiness. So God, as the book of James says, does not himself tempt anybody to sin. He may allow temptations to come, but he himself doesn't cause anybody to sin. He doesn't tempt anybody to sin. He merely, at most, allows that to happen. And so that understanding informs the way we need to look at passages where it talks about God hardening people's hearts, like Pharaoh's heart. It's famous in Exodus. God tells Moses, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart, so he's going to resist the Exodus. But then in the end, he will let Israel go. One of the things that's been pointed out about that incident is that actually the text says that Pharaoh hardened his heart first, and only later did God harden it. And so that may be, and various interpreters have understood it to be, a sign of God simply allowing Pharaoh to go on the sinful course he wanted to go on. Pharaoh hardened his heart, and then God let him do that, and it becomes spoken of as if God had hardened his heart. But really, that's exaggeration to mean that God let Pharaoh continue in his hardened, sinful way. In terms of how God softens hearts, he once again does it in a way that doesn't violate free will. He doesn't override our free will and force us to do good things. But what he does do is give us graces that make it easier to choose to do the right thing. And that's what it means when the Bible talks about God softening our hearts. He's giving us grace to make it easier to do the right thing. And then the reverse of that, hardening people's hearts, is simply not giving them that grace. So it's harder for them to do the right thing, or not as easy as if he had given them special grace. Why would he not give his grace in some circumstances, and thus so-called harden people's hearts? Well, it's partly a mystery. It's part of the problem of evil. But as in the case of Pharaoh, if someone just repeatedly abuses their free will by choosing evil, God may say, okay, well, I've been trying to help this person and they're clearly not responding, so I'm not going to go out of my way to give them extra help. If they're going to turn around, it's going to be a little more difficult for them to turn around, but they can do it because I've given them free will and I'm letting them do it. But if they persist in evil, they may not get all the extra help that they would otherwise get if they consistently use their free will towards good.
Jimmy, very thorough answer. Yovani, thanks so much for the question. Let's go to Alistair in Bangalore, India, calling all the way from Bangalore. Alistair, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi. Jimmy, will the church identify the Antichrist when he comes?
Well, it would be helpful. You know, it'd be really helpful to have the Pope come out and say so-and-so is the Antichrist. That would probably cause a harsh crackdown. You know, during World War II, We had the most Antichrist-like figure, or one of the most Antichrist-like figures of recent memory, Adolf Hitler, and Pope Pius XII really had to wrestle with how much public pushback he could give, lest it cause greater reprisals, because even with the level of criticism of what Hitler's Jewish policies were that he was enabled, that he was able to engage in publicly, if he, this is also Pius XI, if he spoke out against what Hitler was doing to Jewish people, more Jews got arrested and deported. And so if at the end the Pope were to say so-and-so is the Antichrist, you could expect that would intensify persecution of the church. Having said that, I don't know whether this will happen. The church does not have a teaching that at the end the Pope will identify the Antichrist. So I think that's a matter of speculation at this point.
How's that, Alistair?
Okay. Yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah.
Good, good, good. Jimmy, I think of that moment in the 16th century when Pius V excommunicated Queen Elizabeth, and then, you know, very quickly thereafter, there were a lot of English martyrs.
Yeah, yep. Yeah.
Let's go to Anonymous, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for using our app, Anonymous, and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Anonymous, are you there?
Hey guys, thanks for taking.
Good.
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for taking my call. So I want to know if my wife has a reasonable chance at heaven. And let me just give you some background. I'm Catholic. Our kids are Catholic, and she's not Christian. She's not baptized as a Christian, but she comes to church every Sunday. And so I've heard Jimmy in the past say that people ignorant of Christ, you know, won't be penalized necessarily. I'm not saying in the most eloquent way. And so my concern is that because she's listening to the gospel every Sunday with us, is that some kind of tacit rejection of Christ, and is that going to affect her soul?
That's a great
question. One added twist to this is kind of ironic, is that my family is from India. My family actually got converted by St. Thomas in the 50 ADs. My wife is Caucasian, and her mother was baptized a Christian, but got, I'll say, sucked into an Indian guru. So it's just kind of ironic, if nothing else.
Mm. Wonderful question.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for asking. There's no way to judge an individual's heart, so I can't say one way or another. It being exposed to the Christian message is something that can produce the responsibility of, okay, you need to become a Christian. But it's not merely hearing the message. In order to oblige a person to believe something, it needs to be more than just hearing the message itself. To illustrate that, if let's say you're living on a desert island and a Christian washes up on the shore and he's a madman and he preaches the gospel to you and he says Jesus is the Son of God and pigs live in trees and snow is blazing hot, well, he's told you the truth. Jesus is the Son of God. But he's surrounded it with so much nonsense that it doesn't create, he hasn't given you evidence to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. And he's surrounded it with nonsense that would also not create an obligation to believe anything he says. So that's an extreme example. But the same thing applies in principle in every situation. It's not merely hearing the message. One also needs to see enough evidence of one form or another to oblige one to accept the message. And if through no fault of one's own, one hasn't accepted the message, then God will understand that, and he will only hold a person accountable for the amount of light and grace that they had in their lives, and did they live up to that. In terms of going beyond the principles into probabilities, which is what you asked about, does your wife have a reasonable chance? That's something that there are different opinions on. In his encyclical Spes Salvi, Pope Benedict suggests that we may hope, and he doesn't put it as more than a hope, but he says we may hope that today there is a fundamental core of goodness in most people so that they don't end up being lost and going to hell. So he hopes that most people will be saved, but he doesn't know that most people will be saved. On the other hand, other people have estimated the odds differently. And so my suggestion is, let's try to be as sure as we can. You love your wife. Let's see if we can give her the best odds of salvation possible, and do your best when it's reasonable and in the best way, knowing who she is and her background. See if there's a way to say, honey, I really appreciate you coming to Mass with me, and maybe you want to consider becoming a Christian. Maybe you want to consider joining the church, and I'd be happy to help you look at that, or work through any issues or questions that you might have. If you want to see evidence, there's this great organization called Catholic Answers that can hook you up with evidence, or even just saying, hey, honey, let's listen to Catholic Answers Live together. Over time, that could have an effect. So in whatever way is prudent, given your circumstances, I would say do what you can to help your wife embrace the fullness of the Christian faith. That's something that will result in her being happier long term, because the Christian faith brings joy. And don't lose hope, whatever the case.
Anonymous, do you have the book by our colleague Trent Horn, Why We're Catholic?
Yeah, I do, and we had a little thing over Christmas where I said, I'll give you a book to read, you give me a book
okay.
to read, and she wouldn't
uh-huh.
get past the first couple pages.
Right, sure.
You know, before we got married, she said, oh, do you want me to get baptized? And I said, you need to want to get baptized. Don't get baptized just because I tell you to.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, I feel like a failure, but I appreciate everything Jimmy said, and yeah, I just continue to pray to God that she'll come into the church, she's kind of...
Do not feel like a failure, because everybody has free will. Your wife, God gave your wife free will. God respects that. And so you shouldn't take that burden on yourself and say, oh, I failed here. You just want to do what you can to be helpful and loving.
And you have the supernatural gift of hope, and God's grace is pretty extraordinary. And you have the prayers of the Catholic Answer staff for you, Anonymous. Thanks very much for calling. Let's go to Emil in Pennsylvania, watching on Facebook. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello. Hey, big fan.
Did we lose you, Emil?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we start again?
Yeah, sure. Hello?
Go ahead.
You're on the air, Emil. What's your question?
My bad. Sorry. Anyway, hi. I just had one little question. In regards to, I've been a Catholic for about 2 years, so I'm a convert from Protestant. My family's Protestant, but I'm a convert, and I've been a Catholic for about 2 years. And I was the thing about my church is my priest, I've noticed, is very very right wing, very conservative. And me personally, I don't really have a political affiliation. I usually don't really bother with politics. I was raised in a mostly left wing family, and we were always taught that we're right and they're wrong, and he's over here telling me the opposite, and it's kind of like, I try not to get, I told him I'm not a political person, but he just keeps pushing it and pushing it, and he tells me, and he basically said, well, if you're Catholic, you gotta agree with this party, you can't listen to the left, because they're liars, they hate everything we stand for, and such and such, me personally, I don't think that way. I take bits and pieces from both sides and see what I disagree with and disagree with and what stands against my moral as a Christian. But I feel like he's trying to push me all the way to the right. How do I deal with that?
Well, so I guess the first thing to say is there are a lot of different people in the Catholic Church. They have a lot of different opinions. Like James Joyce, the famous Irish novelist, described the Catholic Church by saying, well, here comes everybody. And so you'll find some Catholic priests who are very conservative in their politics. You'll find some Catholic priests who are very liberal in their politics. The same thing happens all over the political spectrum, because the church is a global institution. It's very big. It's got more than a billion members, and they have lots of different opinions in different parts of the world. So you happen to be encountering someone who's coming from a different place politically than you are. In terms of how to handle that, I would say, well, the church does not have an official party that one needs to support. In fact, the church is cautious about parties and tribalism. And frankly, because human beings are fallen, people in every party end up doing things they shouldn't, including lying. And that's just a truth of human nature. You put not your trust in princes, as Chris likes to say, quoting the Old Testament. The If you rely on political leaders like princes, they will let you down eventually. And so what the church has instead of a party is principles. It has basic moral principles and then certain applications to social situations that flow from those. And rather than endorsing a party, it endorses principles. And it's principally, not to put a pun on it, but it's principally up to the individual to learn those principles and to discern them and then to apply them to the situation in which you find yourself, in your place in time and history in the world. And that does at times mean a kind of eclecticism, where you need to listen seriously to what people from a wide variety of different perspectives have to say and analyze them critically, and then do your best to synthesize them in terms of concrete decisions like who to vote for or what measures to support and oppose. And that's something that involves thought. It doesn't involve just taking a party line, because the princes in charge of the party will make mistakes. One of the things we have at Catholic Answers that may be of service to you is a book, if you're watching online, that Chris Check happens to be holding at the moment, called 20 Answers, Catholic Social Teaching. It's by Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press. He's a very intelligent, very thoughtful, and very orthodox thinker. And I would suggest getting a copy of that, maybe getting an extra copy and sharing it with your priest. But always in these kind of situations, even if your priest is interested in talking to you about this, that doesn't mean you have to engage in that conversation. If you've had enough of this discussion, you can say, Father, I appreciate your position. I'm thinking this through on my own, and I'll take into account what you had to say, but let's talk about something else.
My friends, imagine you are there in a conversation with your Protestant brother and he tells you the Catholic Church added books to the Bible. What do you say? Well, Catholic Answers can help, and at no cost to you. Visit shop.catholic.com right now. Click on the banner at the bottom of the page to download our new free ebook, Did the Church Add Books to the Bible? At shop.catholic.com, right back after this.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
The greatest joy in my life is helping others to come to know Christ more fully. And there's no better light on this path, the path to deep union with God, than the wisdom of the saints. Talking about this daily on EWTN Radio is one of the great joys of my life.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett about, less than 10 minutes in this first hour remaining with Jimmy Akin. But the good news is, if we don't get to you in the first hour, we will get to you in the second hour, a whole nother hour, as they would say in some parts of the country.
I like the infix there.
Yeah, I kind of did that in your honor, Jimmy.
Yeah. Thank you.
A whole nother hour coming up after this one of Open Forum. Can we go to David all the way in Sydney, Australia? David, I was in your country last fall. Beautiful place. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, how are you? Good?
Yeah. What can we tell you?
Hello. Oh, yeah. I just have a question about the succession of Peter, St. Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've done a bit of research and I looked into the missionary and the journey of St. Peter. He went to Antioch and he ordained, I think it was Evodius or Ignatius of Antioch to take care of the country or Antioch and stuff. And then he went to Rome and he'd done the same thing to St. Linus and stuff. I just wanted to see, I mean, what's the difference between the successes of Antioch and Rome? I mean, why do Catholics look at Rome instead of Antioch if St. Peter done the same thing in both places?
Yeah, great question.
Well, the basic reason is because of a choice that Peter made. Now, Peter initially was in Jerusalem, and that's where Jesus wanted him to begin his ministry after the resurrection. But he then moved on to Antioch, which was a major city for people who aware. It's a major city in Syria. And because it was such a big city, it was a logical place for Christians to flee in time of persecution and to preach the gospel once they were there. And so that's what happened. There was a persecution in Jerusalem. A lot of Christians fled. Some of them came to Antioch. And because it was a major city and a major trading hub, it was a great place to start evangelizing from. And so that's where actually the first Gentile converts or some of the first Gentile converts ended up being made. And it was natural because it became a significant Christian center for St. Peter to go there after he himself left Jerusalem because of persecution. But he chose not to stay there. As many benefits as Antioch offered as a city with some Christians who were there and as a major trading hub and as a good point of evangelization, he realized there was an even better one. The capital of the empire, Rome. And so he went to Rome. Rome, you know, they have that saying, all roads lead to Rome. Well, in the ancient world, that was not too far from being true. You had people from all over the known world traveling to and from Rome via the Roman system of highway. So that made Rome, as the capital, an even better place to go and evangelize. And there was already a Christian community there. That there had been some Romans in Jerusalem on Pentecost, and they brought their new faith home with them. So there was already a Christian base there. So he went to Rome, he connected with the Christian community in Rome, and then he made that the new site of his ministry to help bring the gospel throughout the Roman world. And so Rome was where he went definitively. It's where he ended his life because it was the better evangelization hub. And so that's why he left his definitive successor in Rome rather than in Jerusalem or in Antioch.
How is that, David?
It's a satisfying answer, but it's just that, I'm still wrapping my head around. I mean, like, I've spoken to so many people about it, and the answers I get is that, you know, his bones are there. That means that's where the successor is. That's where the supremacy and the primacy should stay, not in Antioch. So I don't know if that's right. Is that a proper answer or response you can give to
non-Catholics? His bones being there is true, but that's more of an evidence that he was there and he ended his life there. The fact that he ended his life there and that he chose this place to go to over other places, he went here to conduct the definitive stage of his ministry, and that's where you would expect him to leave his definitive successor, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing to explain to our non-Catholic friends.
All right, David.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
888-318-7884. Gene in Houston, Texas. Let's see if we can get you before we close the hour. Gene, are you there? Gene in Houston, Texas. Wait a minute.
Can you hear me?
Gene, go right ahead. You're running out of time.
Great. Okay, just a quick question. Okay, I have an old Bible that I was either given or I bought many, many years ago. I don't even like the translation much, but the pages are kind of falling out. What do I do with it? I don't want to throw it away. I don't, you know, what's the best thing to do with it?
Has this Bible ever been blessed?
I don't know that.
Okay. Even in the case of blessed objects, there are no official rules for how to dispose of them. For blessed objects, it's customary to either burn or bury them, depending on what the nature of the object. So given it's made of paper, burning would be an option. However, in the case of, that's only a custom, it's not a requirement. And in the case of non-blessed objects, there are no special customs at all.
Catholic Answers Live, 888-318-7884. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with the second hour of Jimmy Akin Open Forum Catholic Answers Live right back after this.